All right, guys, welcome back to the Mind Mate podcast. This is a very special show. I'm pumped for this one. I always love chatting to Geraint. Geraint Lewis, he's a friend of Adventure Fit Radio, actually. Myself and Bill and I, we used to run that show. And every time I've spoken to Geraint, I've always felt like we could have just spoken for hours. Because there's just so much I want to get from this guy. He's an astrophysicist, so he's a scientist by trade. Excuse me, I'm just letting my dog in, but he's very open-minded. And I think what's so cool about him is he sees the world through a scientific lens, pardon the pun, and he has so since 1980 or so this is the 80s when he got his PhD and became a doctor. But he's open-minded to try to understand how this kind of fits into the molds of life. And he's never really seen life fundamentally from a, you know, for example, philosophical or psychological perspective. It's always just been, how can we measure this? How can we quantify this? What's the next, you know, process, plan, theory, experiment, hypothesis? What's the next thing? But he's so good to talk to because he can come at you from that side and then still talk to you on the side of the philosophical. And that's why I love to chat with him because, as you all know, I'm obsessed with the philosophical and the psychological. And I'm always like, yeah, but what does that mean? What does that mean? What does that mean? And, for that reason, I'll definitely be getting Geraint back on the show. In fact, we've just confirmed that we're going to be doing another show 2 weeks from now, and we're going to give ourselves a lot more time to really get right into some of the stuff that we spoke about today, which I think is really, really exciting. And, you know, one of the things that I'm absolutely dumbfounded over and constantly obsessed by is just the sheer impossibility of life. And that was actually one of his first book, actually, that he wrote. He's not just an astrophysicist, he's also an author. And the first book he wrote was called A Fortunate Universe, essentially looking at the science and the physics of how it can be that in this incredible complex universe, there are the grounds from which consciousness and life can spur and grow. And it is unfathomable, but here we are. So he looks at the science, but then towards the end of the book, he kind of ranges on the philosophical and the psychological, I think is really cool too. Guys, before we get into the show, I officially have a sponsor. Woo! I'm very pumped about this because I use these guys for their services all the time. And it's really, really cool that we have now a checkout code and we're doing some work together through sponsorship. So this is for all the budding authors out there, those of you who want to be an author, those of you who have perhaps written your manuscripts but don't know how to take the next steps, or in the process of writing your manuscript but aren't sure what to do. ISBN services, genuinely, I use them. They genuinely take care of everything for you. So they do interior formatting, ISBN registration, exterior graphics design, so you can make the jacket of the book look sick, exactly how you want it to look. They basically turn your book into a professional sellable product. So the coolest thing about this day and age is that the middleman everywhere is breaking down, and individuals and independents have more access than they ever have had before. For budding authors, there was so much politics in it previously. You know, you had to get a book deal and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But in this day and age, if you have a big market or you really think your message is going to sell and it's important, you can just get it out there if you work through the steps. And ISBN services is definitely one of the steps you want to be working through. So the best thing about them as well is you get to keep all the royalties and you get all the publishing rights too. They're literally just making your manuscript into a sellable product. So guys, if this is of interest to you, or if you know anyone who is a writer that has expressed confusion around how to turn the manuscript into a book and get it out in the bookstores and online, head to www.isbnservices.com. You get your book professionally published, paperback, hard copy, and Kindle. Use the checkout code MINDMATE for 10% off. 10% off is pretty cool, guys, because this stuff isn't cheap. It takes a lot of work to get the books done. So I really hope that helps, guys. And of course, enjoy the show. Bye. Great. Long time no speak, as I said to you before the show. I think it's been since 2017 or something. And that sounds like such a wonderful, blissful, easy year compared to what's going on now.
Oh, yeah. The lovely days, the golden past, right?
I know. It was just a simple expedition up to Sydney and a lovely sit down, a nice cup of coffee with yourself, and then we flow back down to Melbourne. It was lovely.
Yeah. And look where we are now.
I know. Well, you've actually gone back in the past. You're in the 1950s.
Yes. 1950s sci-fi. You've got to love 1950s sci-fi. So, yeah.
It's the best.
And I've been catching up on a lot of it, right? So, you know, in lockdown, there's so much to catch up on.
Oh, it's just insane. I know. I found there are always ups and downs with everything. Hey, like I think, you know, especially down here, we've had to sacrifice a lot of freedoms that we were taking for granted, I suppose. But on the plus side, I've been able to do a lot of writing and a lot of reading. And I've read more books than I ever had in my whole life. So there's always, you know, I don't know if I'd probably want to sacrifice the freedom stuff for the rest of my life for the sake of reading, but you got to look on the positive.
Yes. There's opportunity to learn, right? That's the important thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. And since you and I caught up last, so for everyone just listening in now, Geraint, this I think is our third chat now because we did two with Bill and I. We're actually going to start a new show, Bill and I, in the next couple of months.
Oh, excellent.
We'll have to get you on that show as well, mate. You're a long time
friend. Sounds
good. But yeah, the last time we spoke was a while back. But you've written some books in the meantime as well. I don't think you'd written a book before. When did you write your first book?
Oh, so actually, the first book came out in at the end of 2016. So it was only kicking off about then.
Yes.
But in the meantime, we've had another book published earlier this year, and I've got another book coming out next year.
Oh, brilliant.
So, yeah, so it's been a little bit busy. I was supposed to go on a little bit of a book tour to the UK after the book came out, but it was published in February and, of course, haven't been anywhere.
Yes. God, it's just been insane like that. I know.
Yeah, it is like I'm on Mars and you're on Earth and we're doing some dodgy relay.
Exactly. Is that 4-minute time difference?
Absolutely.
So you got these books coming out. So I don't think I don't remember us actually talking about the first book. So give us a bit of an idea of what the first book was about.
Okay. So the first book is called A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos. And it's about this issue in physics, which is really bothersome. So we, you know, live in the universe, we're governed by the laws of physics, and we've got all these mathematical equations, but to use them, there are numbers that we need to know. So if I want to calculate something to do with gravity, I've got to know Newton's gravitational constant. If I want to do something in quantum mechanics, I need to use Planck's constant. And those numbers, you can only find by measuring them. So you can't find them by doing any clever mathematics, you've got to actually measure them. So a lot of people have wondered, right, why does our universe have this particular combination of fundamental constants that control the masses and the forces? And if you play around, you can come up with fake universes, right? I could still have exactly the same questions, but I could change those numbers. I could change Planck's constant, or I could change the gravitational constant. Ask, what's the consequences of that? And the answer is that if you do small changes, the results are catastrophic, right? In the sense that the universe you end up with is very different to the universe we inhabit. And just to give you a simple example, you know, if you mess around with gravity, right? You think, oh, gravity, okay, it's just a force. But gravity controls an awful lot of things, right? It controls the rate that the universe expands. Mm. So, you know, if you wind that number up too big, then the universe is born and collapses in a second.
Yes.
Chances for life in that universe, not much. Or you make it too weak. The universe is born and it expands so quickly that you're left with one atom per observable universe. Chances of life in that universe are also, you know, kind of hard. Mm. And if you play with all these numbers, you'd find out that it's actually very easy to have a universe which is dead and sterile. And so we're left with this question of, why are we in a universe that isn't dead and sterile? Mm. What you find is very, very easy to make a universe which is dead and sterile if you've got a different mix of physics. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, how can we live in a universe where it seems like the physics is just right? And one of the answers to that is kind of obvious, right? We wouldn't expect ourselves to be in a dead and sterile universe because you can have life here.
Yeah.
But then there's a question of, well, we don't really understand how the universe was born and where did it come from. So why did the universe end up with just the right conditions for us to be here thinking about the universe? And this then runs off into speculative physics, this notion that our universe is one universe in this thing called the multiverse, right? So there's almost an uncountable number of universes out there. Each one has a different set of laws of physics, somehow given their laws by some sort of roll of the dice. And most of them are dead and sterile, but of course we're in one that can host us. Mm-hmm. Into the philosophical, some people think, oh, well, maybe that's a sign that this is a simulation, right? So that this is, you know, we've been set up by a grand programmer in another dimension, right? And of course, there is the theological, and there are some that say that this is evidence that God created the universe for us. So yes. The book discusses all of the science, which is most of the book, and then we go into a little bit of the possibilities at the end. So it's a science book with a little bit of philosophy and theology thrown in.
I think that's really awesome. And I think I was going to say, as you were talking there about, you know, that we look at the physics and stuff, like I love philosophy and I love understanding psychological significances of religion. You know, so I'm always thinking just like when we have projected our consciousness onto the night sky, we're really seeing aspects of ourselves. We're not saying, oh, that's a God and that's a this and that. It's really just what we're seeing from the inside, you know? And when you say things like, you know, the physics just lines up perfectly for us to exist, that takes on that kind of natural bias, that self-centeredness approach, like, well, because I'm here, therefore this must all be perfect. And it's that kind of, to your point, it's that religious fundamentalist notion they take. And the perfect metaphor for this is, you know, if a puddle, a water puddle, was conscious and there was a little mound of a hole where it had rained last night, you know, and the puddle just goes, oh my God, I fit this hole perfectly. There must be some kind of transcendent force that's looking after me. It's like, well,
yeah.
From your perspective, yes, but we have to remember that, you know, we're so insignificant compared to how wide and vast the universe is.
Yeah, yeah. But actually that puddle argument is a kind of famous one, actually. And so the fine-tuning one even goes a little bit further. You talk about the way that the water occupies the puddle. But water is a strange substance, right? Mm. And its behavior depends upon the fundamental forces, right? Electromagnetism governs what water does. So the question is, you know, if the universe was slightly different and electromagnetism was different, would there even be water and a hole for the water to go into? So it does run really deep in all of this kind of why are we here kind of thing. And complexity in the universe.
When you're asking yourselves these questions and you're working with, you had a co-author named Luke from memory?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Luke Barnes.
Luke Barnes. Sorry. That's, I remember his last name. Yeah. When you're kind of, you're going through these questions, you're looking at the science, you're also kind of, you know, looking into the philosophy as well. One question that I think arises well is just like how much weight we put onto consciousness, because it's obviously all we have, you know, so it's all we're kind of using. Do you ever think that, you know, we just know so little about consciousness itself that it's very hard for us to kind of make these absolutes when it comes to the laws of the universe?
It's a complicated question. I'm currently reading Brian Greene's book. I think it's called Till the End of Time. And he's a cosmologist trying to broach the entire concept of consciousness. And of course, you know, you could write a book this thick on consciousness itself. So we thought we shouldn't really try and tread there. We want to step back and ask the question of what does the universe need for life, right? Not necessarily consciousness, but for life. And what you need is complexity, right? You need to be able to build things up in different ways, because if the universe was regular, if it was like a perfect crystal, that couldn't store or process information. And so that would be a difficult thing to imagine consciousness in. Mm. So we sort of said, right, the question isn't humans, it isn't consciousness, it's about complexity. Now, and once I've said that, That's something I can write down in the laws of physics, and I don't have to worry about all that brain stuff, which is really complicated.
Complicated, unnecessary. We don't need to talk
about
that.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, so did you, what were some of the findings that you came across as you were writing A Fortunate Universe? It's like, I'm assuming it was like a journey, and as you were looking at the science and some of the other stuff there, you're like, oh, you know, that's kind of an interesting take on something I didn't actually know.
Yeah, well, for me, the interesting part of the journey is that this covers an awful lot of physics, right? So, you know, we're talking about cosmology, we're talking about particle physics, but then you have to talk about atomic physics and molecular physics. And a lot of it was stuff that I had encountered, like as a young student, etc. But to go back and really understand the dependencies, right? It's a tricky thing to think about, right? But so here you are, and you're this big object, and you know you're made of atoms, and you know those atoms are made of electrons, et cetera, all the way down to the quarks and all this kind of stuff. But then to realize that if you mess around with the little bits at the bottom, that it sort of basically propagates its way all the way up. It's sort of like a fine-tuning butterfly effect, right? You change one thing at the tiny scale, and the implications can be massive. So for me, that was kind of cool, because you just don't think about this stuff. When you do a science class, nobody says to you, right, think about another universe. It just said, this is our universe, off we go. So that, for me, that was cool. And also, I must admit, like most scientists, I'm not much of a philosopher. So, you know, it is one of these really bizarre things lots of physicists don't think about the kind of questions that bother philosophers. Mm. What's the nature of time? What's the nature of space? What are dimensions and all this kind of stuff? When you get to play with the fundamental rules of the universe, those are things that you want to play with. Mm. And you have to start to wonder, well, what is space? What is time? Other than just something I wrote in my equations. Mm. So learning philosophy for me, and of course I'm still not a philosopher, but seeing the kind of questions that people ask and then realizing that what I thought was trivial was something actually deep and profound. You've heard of the concept of entropy, right? This notion that the universe is getting more and more disordered. And again, I did my statistical physics class. I thought I knew what entropy was, until you start to read and you suddenly realize, I don't think anybody knows what entropy really is, right? Because there's more than one definition and nobody knows how they interact, those kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So yeah, looking deeper at stuff, I think, was really good.
I think there's this you know, eternal debate between the philosophers and the scientists and the religious and the atheists. But I've been looking into this recently. I was doing a lot of writing myself actually since the last time we spoke, and some of the fundamental differences, we're kind of comparing apples and oranges. And I think there's a really great way, at least, that helped me kind of understand where the differences lie. And it's essentially, in my opinion, that science kind of looks at, the objectivity of, you know, the stuff, the material, what is, what's it made out of? How can we analyze and observe? And then philosophy and psychology, to a lesser extent, is much more about the subjectivity and how to act and what does this mean for us as a, you know, that humanitarian approach. And I think it's so interesting when you say that, when people, because people, you know, as an astrophysicist, someone knows, you know, about the biggest questions. You're obviously, I'm assuming, don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm assuming you're going to attract people that are going to ask you these big questions. You know, what is the meaning of life, you know, given what you know, and all this kind of stuff, you know? And I think that kind of whole meaning of life stuff is, it's much more of a question of, what am I supposed to do with the information that you have learned and observed? Whereas a scientist is primarily doesn't really care about what we're supposed to do. You know, morals don't really come from what a scientist observes and analyzes. Is that your take on things?
Yeah. You can get into battles by arguing over what science is and what scientists, you know, think, etc. And to me, science is what scientists do. And if you, it's kind of interesting that when you look at the scientific method, which is not really something we learn or do, it's just the way science sort of hoofs itself along. Understanding, right, is not really part of it. It's making predictions. My predictions are correct. Making more predictions. My predictions are correct. So, you know, there's a lot of, and I think it was Feynman, maybe you expressed this, shut up and calculate. Don't worry about the way the universe actually works. But if you can predict what's going to happen, then you're doing great science. And you mentioned the friction between philosophers and scientists. And I think this is some of it, in that scientists make predictions, and then you move on and make more predictions and stop into saying, oh, well, what is a Higgs boson? Like, what really is a Higgs boson? We don't do that, right? Mm. We've already moved on. We found the Higgs boson, right? Now we build the next collider.
Yes. That's a really good way of looking at it. It's almost like it's much more, yeah, I can see that. You can almost bring it down to kind of like, let, you know, don't want to make generalizations, but left hemisphere people, right hemisphere people, you know, that those that think about the big and those that are primarily concerned with what's going on right in front of them.
I think that there is a fundamental difference at some level between scientists and philosophers, but of course there's also a lot of intermingling, right? There's lots of scientists who do think about the philosophical side, and there's a lot of philosophers who think about the scientific side. Mm. So it's not as really distinct, mm-hmm. but there are camps that do sort of scowl at each other a bit.
Yeah. And I think, to your point, I think that's where we start to go wrong, where scientists start preaching to the philosophers, you know, that are interested in the subjectivity and how to act, and then vice versa, without actually kind of coming together. Because the intermingling, there's so much beauty in the intermingling. You know, scientists can now predict and show and analyze just how insignificant we are and how big and vast the universe is. And obviously that's going to ripple into some of these philosophic questions pertaining to, you know, humility and exercising, a lack of ego.
I completely agree. But I have seen philosophers tell scientists that scientists don't know how to do science.
Well, that's right.
but because a philosopher has a particular view of what science is, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily what happens at the coalface. So yeah, I'm not expecting there to be some sort of harmonious meetup in the future. This friction seems to be basically written into the two fields at the moment, with a little bit of overlap, but not a huge amount.
Yeah. I just think it's unfortunate. I just don't think it has to be so polarized, because ultimately, you know, you could argue that we're not trying to reach the same conclusion here, but in a way we are kind of trying to find out. It's both philosophy and science, at least in my opinion, are motivated by innate curiosity, and that is something that can unify, and it doesn't have to be so polarizing.
I agree. I definitely agree. I wish there was more opportunity, and in fact I am speaking at a philosophy forum on Wednesday on what is time. So I'm bringing the scientific perspective on what is time to this discussion. But you know, one of the honest truths is that there is very little opportunity for physicists and philosophers to get together, right? Mm. It's just, we don't go to the same conferences. I think we barely go to the same coffee shops. I mean, we have different departments that don't meet, etc. So yeah, so it is one. It's not made easier by the university structure and the demands on you at a university, right?
Yes.
I mean, we know how we get rewarded, how research is done. Hanging out with a philosopher in the coffee shop for a couple of days, that doesn't really get you anywhere.
No. So, I have this innate humanitarian thing in me. I just wish we could all get along.
Absolutely.
Organization's fun.
Yeah. No, I do agree. And, you know, I do think back to, I don't want to say the golden age of science, right? Because there never was a golden age. But there was a different approach to science in the 1800s and maybe even the early 1900s with regards to how science progressed. There wasn't the same pressure on people. There was an opportunity to talk and intermingle, which is just less prevalent today, but maybe things will change again in the future.
Absolutely. And you know, that idea about science having a progression, I'm really interested in that as well. There was a book that I read recently called Maps of Meaning by Jordan mm-hmm. Peterson. It's a huge book, and he basically talks about the evolution of morality. And his basic idea, because he was really interested in Jean Piaget in the 20th century, and he really wanted to kind of bring this whole dispute to an end, or at least just kind of try to understand where both sides, you know, the subject and the object, were coming from, essentially. And his basic thesis in that is that evolution, so morality, kind of evolved out of the way we act. So because you can watch mammals and you can look how they merge into social hierarchies and things, and it's as if they're kind of governed by the laws that we can explicitly state, but obviously they're unconscious, you know. So they're operating together, and you know they can see where the dominance hierarchy is, and it's if they're saying, you know, that's enough and you should go and do this. It's how we operate, but they obviously can't even talk. So
yeah.
Basic idea is that you have this morality that evolves out of acting and then watching ourselves act and then abstractly representing that over time and years and decades and centuries. And eventually what you get is myth and then religion and then philosophy and then science. And it begs the question that, you know, what's going to come after science? What's the next up-to-date way to understand the world? Have you ever thought about that? Like, what could be the transcendent science?
Well, I don't know what it would be, but there are a lot of people who say that science at some level is reaching a stagnation point. In the sense that we now have a theory of the very small, the standard model of particle physics, the theory of the very large, the standard model of cosmology. They both work exceptionally well, and we know that they both must be wrong at some level. They must be incomplete, right? Wow. Because particle physics doesn't contain the stuff that we see in the universe, right? It doesn't contain dark matter. We know there's a lot of dark matter out there. It doesn't contain dark energy. And we know there's this stuff which is causing the expansion to accelerate. And standard model of particle physics doesn't contain gravity. Whereas on the large scale, we use Einstein's general theory of relativity, which does describe gravity, but none of the other forces. Mm. And we can put matter and energy in, but that doesn't tell us what that matter and energy actually is. So we've got these highly, highly successful working theories, and we are desperate for something to break. We want an observation that doesn't fit, because that tells us where we should go, mm. and we're just not finding it. Right. So, you know, scouring the skies, looking for things that don't fit, scouring their particle accelerators, things that don't fit. And some people are suggesting that we've reached this point because we have become separated from philosophy. We've stopped asking the what is really going on questions. Mm-hmm. And we've relied on this. I'm going to make a prediction and move on. I'm going to make a prediction and move on. Adjust my maths, etc. And so maybe it is that science and philosophy will have to come back together such that we can have a new way of asking the questions, because all we're doing now is asking this, you know, questions in exactly the same way. And there are people who wonder that maybe if it is the scientific method that's the problem, then maybe we need a new approach to asking questions. So
what do you think?
We don't know. I wouldn't hazard a guess, tell you the truth. I mean, because again, I'm not enough of a philosopher. I do have this feeling. Look, I'm old enough now that I see the adoption of ideas into science, which were flaky-ish when I was a young scientist, mm-hmm. have become more solidified now. But the sort of evidence behind it hasn't increased as much as the, and I'm going to put the word in air quotes, belief uh-huh. in it. So dark matter is one of the topics, right? So dark matter is thought to be this matter that pervades the universe, right? It's the dominant mass out there. And back in the 1980s, when I started my science career, that's essentially when this notion of dark matter, it was out there, it's been discovered. It was like, we need something else in the universe. Mm-hmm. And there were ideas that, well, maybe it is a substance, right? Or maybe it's that we've got gravity wrong. Maybe we don't understand gravity on large scales, right? And what has happened is that the entire field is basically lent one way towards it being a substance, right? Because it's easy to deal with if you think of it as a substance.
Yes.
And it's harder to deal with if you want to say that gravity is wrong, because gravity in its current form, that was derived by Einstein. And so, you know, you need a big brain to take the next step there and in the right direction. And, you know, we've now gone in this direction where most of the field thinks it's a substance, and there are experiments being built to search for it as a substance. There's one up the road from you in Stawell, actually, in the old gold mine. They're building a physics laboratory to search for dark matter particles.
Wow.
And a fraction of a percent say, no, gravity could still be wrong. But the consensus shifted one way, and we haven't really ruled out the other idea. And so this is, you know, again, this is one of those things that science does have these issues about it with, that people like the current idea and the current idea becomes the thing and then you move on again.
Yes.
And maybe this is how you've ended up at this. You've gone down, you know, a whole series of alleyways and you've finally reached the blind alley. How far do you backtrack to before you find the right path?
Yeah.
And this is, I don't know the answer. But some, you know, I know there are people that say in the dark matter 1980s, there are people saying, oh, well, physics started to go wrong in the 1930s. You know, others, you know, saying it was a bad idea that we came out of the sea in the first place, kind of thing. Right? But
fair claim to that.
Yeah. So it's a big question, and it could be wrong, right? In the sense that tomorrow, some smart person might just go, hang on, I can put gravity and the other forces together and bang, we're off in a new direction. But a lot of people are feeling that, you know, we've been now spinning our wheels, developing these fundamental theories for, well, you know, Einstein on his deathbed was working on unifying gravity with the other forces.
Yeah.
And that was 1955. And here we are now, and we have definitely made advances. We definitely understand the workings of the universe in a lot more detail, but we do seem to be hitting this brick wall, and we've been hitting it for a long time. So yeah, I don't know. My money is on, okay, because I have great faith in humanity. My money is on that as education systems around the world get better and better, and we can tap into the mental power, right? We know that there are smart people all around the world without opportunity to do science, that somebody somewhere, you know, I can't remember there was a great scientist who made a quote about this, that, you know, that their worry about science is that a great mind was locked in a sweatshop in India.
Yeah.
Right. Rather than having the opportunity to contribute.
Yes.
And of course, as education is improving around the world, hopefully it will come, but we, you know, I said there is a bit of a dark cloud of pessimism that maybe we can't see through this wall.
Yeah,
and I'll mention one other thing as well, which is even more terrifying, in the sense that maybe we can't see through this wall because we are slightly evolved apes and we just don't have the brain power.
Yes,
right. You know, we've done well, right? Congratulations, us. Right, but you know, it's been a couple of million years since we were picking fleas off each other and swinging in the trees.
Some are still doing it.
Some are still doing it. So it might be that, you know, that maybe there is a limit to human mental capacity, and we might not ever be able to see the answer. And I as a human, I can't even imagine what that means.
No.
But we do know that a dog can't do integrals, right? The dog doesn't know, but you know, so how do we know what we don't know?
Yes, exactly right. But I suppose, like, because one of the most fascinating theories to come out of psychology and neuropsychology is neuroplasticity, and this the brain's ability to learn and grow. And that's now, you know we thought that the brain was hardwired really, and then neuroplasticity came along and just blew all that out. And then epigenetics came along and threw all the hardwired biology theory out as well. So we really start looking, and this is where the new age spiritualists love this idea, because it's kind of like, you know, these new theories are coming out that are really kind of pushing against that hardwired material. This is who we are. This is how we've evolved, you know, and you can start to see them jumping towards the transcendent ideas, the we are nothing but conscious awareness stuff. And, you know, potential can be infinite because we can apply ourselves here and grow there, or, you know, because we're plastic and we can keep growing. And one of the things that you said there is, you know, it, to me, it sounds like this almost kind of this spiritual idea of burning off the dead wood so that you can continue to grow. Maybe we just reached the point where science has got us this far, and now it's something that is evolving from, you know, the bottom up approach is going to take us to this next area. We don't know what we're going to be calling that, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, there is a very, and I've only really come to appreciate this in the last few years. There is an area of science which I think is very, very important in that, you know, science, you pick up a science textbook, it's all about the equations, right? Mm-hmm. Mathematical equations. And, but what you find is that when you deal with real stuff, us or the universe, maybe our atoms, et cetera, are governed by those equations. We can write down an equation to talk about how atoms interact. But then you get into this notion of complex systems, how many different things doing simple things interact to produce complex behavior. Mm. And we realize that we can't write down the equations to describe that complex behavior in a simple fashion. Mm. It just becomes too difficult to calculate. And I think that maybe that this will be a direction that we will have to go in the sense that, you know, we did the easy part, right? We wrote down the equations, and so the equations themselves might be very, very ugly, but that's the easy part. The hard part is asking, right, now I've got something governed by all of those equations. What's the emergent behavior? So that's the phrase at the moment. What emerges from simple things interacting? Mm. And, you know, there are definitely those that think that consciousness, intelligence, are related to things in your mind, neurons, which are simple things. They have a potential and they fire. Put them together in a complicated network and suddenly you can store memories, you can think, you have a consciousness. But, you know, we're a long way from talking about the activity in the brain, although people are trying to do this, from how these simple things work.
Yeah.
So, and I'll mention that I know, a scientist at the moment, I won't mention her name, but she is my wife, but who's working on synthetic intelligence. Can you build a mechanical device that has the properties of the neurons in the brain such that it rewires itself in the same way as you talk about neural plasticity? Whoa. And so it can learn, right? You Wow. feed it stimulus and it restructures itself to know how to respond to that stimulus.
Wow.
So, you know, that gets into, that's almost science fiction, right?
Yeah.
Asimov and positronic brains, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, that's where people are thinking, right? Maybe I can just worry about the equations for the simple things and then look at what emerges when I put lots of simple things together.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that idea that, because, yeah, and again, it comes back to that idea of us being inherently self-centered, you know, and our anxiety it's the emotion of self-centeredness. We're always kind of worried how we fit into the jigsaw puzzles of things, you know, and, you know, we can look at a dog. I've got a dog right here, just walked in by itself, opened the door, you know, and I assume that it doesn't have self-awareness because I can just look at the size of its prefrontal cortex. It's much smaller than mine, I hope. It's definitely governed by the mammalian brain, you know, by emotions and feelings. I can see positive emotion and negative emotion when we interact, but I don't know it possesses the ability to record a podcast on Zoom. So it's one of those things, but coming back to that point you were making about science reaching its kind of, you know, the last dead end or something, does this come back to, is it almost necessary for science then, do you think, to step back and ask itself what it's actually doing as a model of trying to understand the universe. Is the idea behind science to become omniscient? Like, what's the goal? If we're reaching all of these dead ends and things, do we need to take a step back and go, okay, what are we doing?
It depends how close to that wall we're gonna get. I mean, you have to sort of remember, right? As scientists in their day job, most of them are focused on a very small area. So, you know, one person might be trying to measure the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon or something. Others might be, I'm observing the rotation curves of distant galaxies. So, you know, science is, it's not a single enterprise, right? It's thousands of people around the world squirreling away on their things. And to them, the notion of the big picture problem is often not seen, right? You blink it and you look in this way. But I think that maybe we do need to take a step back, but how you do that, right? How do you organize for all of science to say, I'm going to take a step back? Now, you have to remember, of course, the majority of scientists in the world, I'm not thinking about the fundamental.
Yeah.
Right. They're not thinking about the makeup of the universe at the tiny scale or the large scale. Most of them are solid state physicists worried about materials and surfaces and the battery technology and all that kind of stuff, right? Lots and lots of very practical stuff. Mm. They're making great advances, so they're fine. But the question of how you do that with the fundamental aspects of the universe, who is it you're asking to take a step back? Mm. And even if you ask them, what does that actually mean for them? And, you know, how do you tell people that you need to do something different and make sure they all start doing something different when they're all just doing their own thing anyway?
Yeah, right? Exactly. And so, it should come from the people doing it as well. I mean, I have absolutely no stake in this to be like, hey, you guys, I mean, I've read a couple of books.
Yeah. Well, and there are scientists who are saying that maybe we do need to change things. But, you know, scientists are stubborn buggers. They will only really change if things really, really stop working, right? Mm. If you know, I will try not to be too mean to old scientists, but there's a saying, right? It's that science progresses one funeral at a time.
Mm.
And what that means is that, it takes a long time for old ideas, old approaches to disappear. What is needed is a new approach needs to come in and says, look at what you can get if you do this instead of that. And then the junior scientists take it on and then things expand. But by a decree by fiat isn't going to work.
No, but it's not just scientists either, though. It's just human beings. I mean, look at our response to climate change. You know, it's just,
what response?
Exactly right. Exactly right. I wouldn't say it's scientists. It's just human nature is just we're fearful of change. It's, you know, it's existentially confusing. We like being safe and comfortable. And a big part of that is ideological safety and opinions staying the same, because then we don't have to think differently, and thinking is scary.
Yeah, exactly. And thinking that, you know, there are things going on beyond our control, right? That, you know, we can't control the climate. We can help limit what we do, but we can't control it. Look, we could get into a long debate here about all kinds of things, and
it's true,
capitalism and blah blah blah, and it'll be up until the last minute, and then we'll go, everything will change.
Yes.
We'll have to live through some disasters, but we will learn our lesson just after it's too late.
It's true. I do really agree with that. I think if there's something that's wonderfully paradoxical and profound about human nature is that we wait till the very last second and then we go, oh shit, we have to do something. And then we do eventually learn our lesson. It's just like, how much good are we going to carry through the mud in order to get to that next utopia?
Well, yeah, I talk about it. I've got a talk where I talk about the long-term future history of the universe, right? What we know is that in about a billion years, our sun will have gotten to be too hot that the sunlight would basically burn off the atmosphere and evaporate the oceans. So humans, if we survive that long, in a billion years, have to leave the planet.
Yep.
But we would do it the day before, right?
That's true.
Yeah, we were waiting to that point and go, okay, let's go now. And it's just bizarre. It is just very, very bizarre. So
it's just the Titanic. We'll all be a part of the concert. We'll be playing the violin. Yeah. We'll jump on the last boat.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's unbelievable. Grant, I know I've got to get you out of here in about 10 or so minutes, but
okay.
That was a hell of a lot of time on the first on the first book. We'll put some show notes. What are the, I suppose we should jump to the book that you're kind of working on now. Have you given anyone an idea of what you're working on, or keeping that a secret?
We can start talking about it because we've delivered the final manuscript. So I wrote this book with Chris Ferry. Do you know Chris?
I've heard that name, yeah.
He's written a series of books of something for babies, like quantum mechanics for babies,
yes.
cryptography for babies.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So he's got a lot of those, but this book is not for babies. And it's we're still sorting out the final title, but it's something along the lines of the quark and the cosmos. No, the quantum and the cosmos. Sorry, I got the word quark in my head there. The quantum and the cosmos. And essentially what we're trying to do is demonstrate that in understanding the life of the universe, we have to talk about the large scale and we have to talk about the small scale. Mm-hmm. And so these ideas, which seem very different when they get presented often, the cosmology in the expanding universe and quantum mechanics and what goes on the small scale, they are implicitly tied together if you want to understand phenomena in the universe. So we sort of talk about the early stages of the universe today, and the universe in the future, and how the cosmology and quantum mechanics are intertwined in all of that. So it's meant to be a bit of a guide to the entire life of the universe, from woe to go, and questions of where did the universe come from and where did the universe go? Where's the universe going to? It's not meant to be a long book. It's short, sharp. This is the life of the universe, and this is how we think things work.
That's brilliant. It's brilliant because I think it's just so unfathomable to even conceptualize how small we go. You mentioned the word quarks. You know, that idea that that's essentially like the atoms and even small subatomic particles. You know, and then how vast it is, and then. Where I get confused about seeing the world, seeing the universe as some kind of material entity, because what it's made of is so small and so vast, it doesn't make any sense to me. This is because I'm not a scientist, but it doesn't make any sense to me that we can find ourselves in this kind of middle plane. You know, we can perceive ourselves from the level of hands and face, you know, but we know when we're talking about this and it's been measured that it's so much smaller than that. Like it's just so unfathomable.
I mean, as a scientist, I have to think about it, right? So, you know, I do like to think that it is true that human beings, the scale of a human being is actually on a logarithmic scale, halfway between the smallest and the largest sizes that we worry about. In the universe. So, you know, we are in that, as you said, this middle ground. It is kind of interesting, isn't it, that all of that stuff, the very small and the very large, has basically been hidden from us, hidden in quotes, over most of the life of human beings. Mm. We've only uncovered the very small over the last 100 or so years. Mm. We've only discovered the extent of the universe over the last 100 or so years. Up until that point, you know, no notion that we're made of smaller stuff, right? We know there's little bits and pieces, but not atoms. Or that there's really anything beyond the stars. The stars are out there, and then maybe that was it. But this idea that there are billions of light years out there, that's a very, very new concept. So, you know, most of the time you just went, nah, there's the sky, there's the ground, there's me, that's it. But now you have to go, and there's quarks, and there are so many quarks. If you think about how many quarks there are and how big the universe is, right? It is kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. Is it okay for a scientist to be blown away by that, or they have to consistently focus on the measurements and the predictions and things?
Yeah, you can spend 5 minutes being blown away, right? But this is one of the bizarre things is that, you know, I've been a scientist now for almost 30 years since I started my PhD. Mm-hmm. And you just get into the habit of writing things down and not thinking about it. So I will often write down one problem, like looking at a galaxy, right? You know, so I know that in the galaxy, there's probably 200 billion stars. So I can write down 200 billion. A billion is a number I can sort of understand because that's related to people on Earth, right? So 200 billion. Now, I know the mass of each of those stars is about the mass of the sun. And the sun is around 10 to the 30 kilograms, right? So already that's a big number, right? So, you know, one followed by 30 zeros. So the mass of that galaxy, you know, is around 10 to the 42 kilograms. All right, so I'll write that down. I'm quite happy with that.
Yes.
But then I say, well, that's now made of protons and neutrons, and they have a mass of around 10 to the minus 27 kilograms.
Oh my goodness.
So I put those all together. Now that inside that galaxy, there's around 10 to the 50 of these protons and neutrons. And you have problems where you work with these numbers, and you just don't think about them anymore, right? They're just... They're numbers on a page, but you do stop and you sort of think, that's really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about all these individual bits and pieces.
It's insane, isn't it? And I mean, we do that a lot. You know, I think you can look at, I'm very interested in childhood development, you know, developmental psychology. And you look at a child and they're just mesmerized by the world and they're putting everything in their mouth because they just, you know, they're almost like one with the world because they, you know, they don't have an ego yet. So they're not disconnected and separate from all the things because they're trying to figure out all the things, you know. But when we get to adulthood, you know, it's just like, yeah, I'm speaking to Geraint, he's a friend of mine. I'm speaking to him on a tiny little screen in real time. You know, he happens to be hundreds of kilometers north from me right now, but we're speaking in real time, you know, and we're actually just primates that wear shoes. But yeah, that's mm-hmm. normal. You know, we actually forget about we lose the awe for the routine.
Well, exactly. And it's not only losing the awe, we also lose, I think, a little bit of the curiosity, right? Mm. I mean, I have a microwave over there. Ask most people, how does a microwave work?
Exactly.
And you may, the answer may as well be magic.
Yeah, it should, right? Totally.
Yeah. And ask how is the communication getting from my laptop here to your computer there? What's going on? Again, it might as well be magic, right? Absolutely. Because most people have no idea, right? And they don't need to know. And so you just keep doing your stuff. But in reality, if you think about it, and again, I could write down the numbers about how many electrons are moving in here. And again, we'd be there with these huge numbers and about all the fields and then the quantum mechanics stuff going on.
Yes.
In reality, everything is kind of amazing.
It's phenomenal. And this is... I think what would be lovely, actually, Geraint, is we organize another time to chat, maybe in a week or two, and we could do like a part two, because we had, for everyone listening, this would be edited now, but we had some internet difficulties in the beginning. But yeah, we should do a part two. I think that'd be brilliant, Geraint. But
that would be great.
Yeah, awesome. I was just going to make a point there about, you know, what's true, you know, and understanding truth there, because your point, it's like you could say it's magic, and that would almost be enough for me when it comes to what a microwave is, because you would throw this, if you were a microwave expert, you would throw this jargon at me such that it would just become arbitrary. And I'd just be like, magic makes sense. In the same way that the word malaria means bad air. Now that is a kind of truth because, you know, prior to understanding how mosquitoes, spread the disease and all that sort of stuff, you could just essentially sit back and be like, well, that air is bad. You know, it's a different kind of way of saying it's not scientifically accurate or objectively accurate, but it is a nuanced kind of truth.
I completely agree. And of course, even with the scientific answers, you have to be careful with the word truth. Mm. Scientists don't like the word truth because what we have are ideas that work. Now, whether or not that is the actual way the universe is, we don't know. And we can never know at some level. Mm. And we just go with what works. Mm. So I can talk about magnetic fields, electric fields, electrons, etc. But the next theory of physics that might come along might do away with all of those concepts.
Yeah.
As long as the experimental results come out to be the same. The notion that they're truly an electric field, a magnetic field, you know, that's a concept for the idea I've got now, but maybe not from the idea I've got tomorrow.
Yes, yes. And, you know, to bring it back full circle, this is why I think it's impossible to be a consciously arrogant scientist, because if you're truly a scientist, you have to have some humility there based on, you know, that morality there, kind of what you said there is like, well, this works for now. There's a lot of humility in what you're saying.
Yes, there is, but God, man, there's a lot of ego in science. But yeah. That the ego, the humility, the ego comes from chest thumping, right?
Yes.
You know, things like big prizes, Nobel Prize. I got the Nobel Prize. You know, hey, look at me. so there is ego there, but I think if a lot of scientists took time to think about the universe, there would be a bit more humility.
Yes. Maybe that's just, yeah, that's your faculty, because you're an astrophysicist. You're constantly dealing with the vast, you know. Basically, I'm just getting around you, mate. You know, you're a humble man, and I've liked you since I met you.
That's good to hear.
Well, great. We'll have to do a part two, I think. We so many things I want to talk. I want to talk about your second book. I want to just keep talking. I love it. And we'll make that happen. Hopefully in the next couple of weeks, if you're free.
Yeah. Next couple of weeks works well for me.
Done. We'll lock it in. So this will be part one. And guys, thanks so much for listening. Tune in for part two. That'll be brilliant. Great. Thank you so much, mate.
Thank you.
Cheers, guys. Bye.